Just sit up straight, suck your stomach in, because you're liable to be on TV. And with that, let's move directly to Esther and Zach.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Bark and to the reading tonight. I'm Esther.
And I'm Zach. And tonight we have for you two readers. First, we have Desiree Amy, and second, we have Zach Gerberick. But before we get started with the reading, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
That's an excellent place to start. Wonderful. Before we get started with the reading, I just want to remind you of a few of the ground rules here at the Bark during the readings. We ask that while the readings are in progress, you please not get up and traipse across the front of the room to the restroom, but instead maybe wait until the first reader has finished. Secondly, we ask that there be no speaking or cell phone use or cell phone vibration or cell phone ringing or babies crying during the readings. So please silence your mouths, children, and phones at this time. Furthermore, there is no smoking inside the Bark. I think that covers it. Okay, so let's get us off the stage, and without further ado, to introduce our first reader, please help me welcome Emily Childers.
Hi, how are you all? Okay. So a few weeks ago, I was scrolling through Facebook and came across an article about a fisherman who had caught a cotton candy blue lobster. My first thought was that I needed to work that into Desiree Amy's introduction somehow. Because if we were lobsters, she'd be the neon one making headlines. I met Desiree Amy several years ago in an undergraduate fiction technique class. She was quieter then, but her writing stood out. I don't know many people who would not only workshop a story about the very people in the class, but then kill them all off by the end. But that's Desiree. She's the type of person who will willingly rent an apartment from a man who calls himself Sexual E. Manatee. She's the person who immediately finds an anthropology in any new city she's in, and she's in a different city every weekend. She's the person who uses her cat Leo to illustrate Kant's points in a seminar paper. Desiree is the boldest, weirdest person I know, and I love her. She is my cotton candy blue lobster, and I can't wait to hear the piece she's prepared for us tonight. I give you Desiree Amy.
Ah, hello. So I am so infinitely excited that I get to spend my cotton candy lobster life with a best friend like Emily. Thank you for that wonderful intro. All right, so tonight I am reading a piece called Inspiring Adulteress Goes to the Gyno. My first gynecological exam took place almost exactly 7 years after the last time I visited my pediatrician. I was 22. The only doctor I'd ever known was a brilliantly strict woman who'd urged my parents to feed me more vegetables and less chicken nuggets. Her name was, and likely still is, Dr. A. And back then, her office was yellow and packed with outdated children's magazines curling at the corners. The receptionists wore bright colored scrubs, and when they took my weight and blood pressure and checked my lungs and ears, they tried to make me laugh. I don't recall ever feeling unsafe. Dr. A said the things you expect a children's doctor to say, but she'd always add in her two cents about family dynamics. According to her, my sister and I needed to prepare ourselves for our future husbands. This meant that my mother should be teaching us to cook and to clean and to wear dresses and skirts that stretched below our knees. Around 2006, when I was in the sixth grade, Gardasil alleged a campaign for their HPV vaccination marketed to preteen and teenage girls. My mother asked Dr. A when I could get mine. The doctor explained that although I had a cervix, I did not need the vaccination. She would not advocate for such a drug because, in her professional opinion, cervical cancer only happens to girls who are sexually active. She and my mother agreed that I was low risk. Still, my mother explained that I'd begun to menstruate and asked for a referral to a gyno. That, Dr. A explained, was only necessary if I was having sex. Again, she and my mother agreed that I was low risk. My last two appointments were a physical that ended with my first of three rounds of the Gardasil vaccine and a follow-up for the second. I was still sexually inactive, but Dr. A had a change of heart, or maybe it was finances, that moved her to tape posters of the anti-HPV drug on the walls in her exam room. At 15, the way that my doctor recanted her initial apprehensions about a drug she was sticking in my arm seemed odd. I Googled the side effects and pleaded with my mother not to make me get it because I'd read somewhere on some website that it may cause early menopause. Still, she sent me with my father to Dr. A's office, where my concerns were met with tiny band-aids to cover the tiny pricks on my bicep. My father didn't ask questions, but we never went back for the third round. There are certain things my parents never felt they needed to say to me. Even when he found a stash of cheap pregnancy tests in my car, my father didn't tell me to use protection. When my almost boyfriend left me for my best friend in the 10th grade, my father said that all men want just one thing and left me to fill in the rest. My mother agreed with Dr. A that gynecologists and birth control were only necessary for impure girls, and I could not be one of them. She had theories about evils of thong underwear, belly buttons, and why I should wear pads instead of tampons to the beach. Our talks about sex were so far and few between that I can only piece one fully together. I don't know what would be worse. If you told me you were a lesbian or came home pregnant, either way, you won't stay at my house. That was an ends to a means, which I can now translate to, if you're going to have sex, it better require a condom, and you'd better hope that condom works. The day before my gyno exam, I scheduled the appointment for 8 a.m., hoping that the wellness clinic would be as empty as it was. I walked up the stairs, met the receptionist, filled out the intake forms, and started to cry. In the exam room, I undressed, put on the plasticky smock-like thing, and continued to cry. My new doctor only asked me once why I couldn't stop, and when I didn't have an answer, she told me that she's been doing these kinds of checkups for a very long time, and everything looks normal. But a woman my age, she said, is too old to be seeing a doctor like her for the first time. I need to schedule annuals and to stop smoking cigarettes. I thought about how right she was, but I meet so many wonderful people when they light them for me. The following are the thoughts I could have had between the things I said to my gynecologist before I left and finally stopped crying. Number one, call me Sarah. During my sophomore year of college, which was also my junior year of high school, I innocently adapted my friend Sarah's identity. Anna, Will, and I made a habit of being things we were not, mostly older versions of ourselves to get into bars before we turned 18. Sarah had ugly hair, greasy and untamed curls, with discolored skin that made her look dirty even when she was clean. She had a birthmark above her top lip and very kind eyes. I was not a friend that she liked to keep, mostly because our psychology professor accused us of cheating on our take-home midterm. This, she thought, was my fault for having too big of a mouth and not enough common sense or decency to care about the things that I say. Naturally, I map-quested her house, printed the directions, and handed them to her before class. We're going to be friends. I needed a Sarah in my life to offset the messiness of skipping youth group to search for meaningful conversations in the inebriated homeless population of downtown Melbourne. So when she said that she would meet us all on a Thursday night and didn't show up, I told the man lighting my cigarette that I was Sarah. The next Monday, when I told the real Sarah this story, she laughed. Later that year, she went away to school. Number two, door on fire. In a place like Melbourne, secrets aren't easy to keep. Most of my friends know my father cheated on my mother. Ashley caught him at the gym. Anna, Will, and I followed leads to her house. A confidential informant named Scott said he'd heard that I have a half-brother. This was news to me, but no less shocking than the 14th or 15th time my mother asked me to be her little spy. Does your father talk to Melissa's mom when he picks you up from school? The receptionist at my dentist said she was sure that he'd been spending time at Lisa's house, even though Lisa had four kids and a head too big for her small eyes. But he said, she said is hearsay, and my father said that lady was crazy. They're all crazy. The Melissa's moms, the Lisa's, the April's, the Wendy's, the Gina's, and even my mother's first cousin. But adultery is not a matter for children. It's not the kind of dinner table talk that makes a father comfortable. It's not the kind of accusatory thing my mother loved to hang on our walls. It's what she cried about on the bathroom floor while he worked the overnight shift. And it's what she'd leave. It's why she'd leave us with my Aunt Judy on school nights to sit in her car outside of his police station. The dispatchers thought my mother was a bitch. After my brother was born, my parents separated for a year. My mother kept our three-bedroom house, the one with the green carpets and constant stream of fire ants in the closets. My father rented a baby blue trailer on site at Johnson Middle School. This is where I learned to use the microwave to cook fish sticks, how to make a fan out of a piece of white computer paper, and how to hide the cell phone my mother stole from my father under my pillow so he wouldn't find it. "If you use it," she said, "the police will come get you." I was 5 years old. When I told her that April took me to the beach and stayed over sometimes, I didn't think my mother reacted. By the end of the year, my father came back home. I tried to use a hairdryer to melt the carpet in my bedroom. For 18 years, they did these same things: business trips, burner phones, dispatchers, and gang members. What most of my friends don't know is that my mother cheated on my father. She'd fly to New Jersey and come home strange. One morning, a neighbor we'd never met banged on our back window while it was still dark. "Your front door is on fire." The fireman said it was an accident. Palm Bay was only 3 miles away and had gone up in flames that month because of a drought. "It must have been a rogue ember," my mother said. "It was one of my father's women." We bought a new front door, scrubbed the smut from the walls, and stopped talking about it altogether. Number 3, married men don't lie. Matt built his pickup from the scraps of an old RV. He's confident in what his calloused hands can do. When he speaks, it's mostly about childhood traumas, like the time a man accidentally held his father at gunpoint while he and his brother hid in a closet. That was when they lived in some townhouse somewhere near a bay in Maine, where his father once owned a boat cleaning service. Just a misunderstanding. He blames it all on being in the wrong place at the wrong time, then describes his mother. "She," he says, "is in some prison in Ocala. That's probably where she'll die." By the time I met this man, I had been gone for some time, a few years at college and some months of keeping it weird in Austin, Texas. He liked country music, the beach, and not talking about his wife while we laid on the white sheets in a Doubletree bed. "I've never done this before," he said, and I was sure he hadn't. Not that it really mattered anyways, because I was toying with the idea of making this a habit. Married men, I thought, what an adventure. Number 3, fudge-covered animal crackers. If you go to Walmart to buy Keebler's pink and white fudge-covered animal crackers, you won't find them. For me, this is equally as devastating as it is a good omen. April was clear about her rules in the store: stay where I can see you. This meant in front of or next to the cart, but not behind it. And I did as I was told, but her little boy did not. When I remind my dad of the story, he tells me that April never had a son. So I wonder who that boy was, and remember that I can't remember his face. She fed us fudge-covered animal crackers with rainbow sprinkles. Number 4, Married Men Don't Lie, Part 2. My little sister's first love tried to choke her, and not in the good way. Her second love snuck into her car while she slept and left messages for her father about her unruly behavior. Her most recent love promised he'd leave his wife when his 9-month-old twins turn 18. She wrote him a note that she stitched together from self-help YouTube videos and sent it 2 days after his grandfather's funeral. He cried, she said, and wondered if she was serious about ending their 5,000-mile relationship. What relationship? Phone calls in the middle of the night, but never on weekends? Loveness under the pseudonym of business trips scheduled 3 months out? His wife had a suspicion, and my sister kept screenshots of their Christmas card quality family pictures. It was all just too much. Number 5, my grandma thinks I'm a clairvoyant. I tend to see things in my dreams that the universe explains later. A ghost in my bedroom, house is up in flames, pregnancy scares that belong to everyone else but me. My grandma says I am clairvoyant. She checks my horoscope when I apply for jobs and spreads holy water on every new car that I park in her driveway. I wonder if I know the landscape of new towns before I get there because I'm reincarnated, which she says is entirely possible. Number 5, floor plans and 4 a.m. phone calls. That experience didn't make me understand the world any more or any differently than I already did. It didn't jade me or make me more careful, but I couldn't get the stench of his gaze off my shoulders. I couldn't unmemorize the layout of his studio, the upturn of his head from his computer screen, or the weight of his arm on my torso. The grime of his fingernails clinging to my body put inscription in context more than any book I'd ever read, but I was fine. The third 211 Big Ben dispatcher I talked to was tired because I only thought to make these kinds of phone calls at 4 a.m. She asked me, why now, coaxed me from my perch on the ledge, and said it was never my fault. STD tests are healthy in a way that trauma is not. You're seeing someone new, she said, and you just want to be sure. Earlier, the automated teller said I should call 911 if there was an emergency. On a similar morning, I think I'd like to be somebody's third wife. While I collected the reflection of green lights on the roof of my Corolla, it seems fair that they've done it all before and should know what to do when it comes time for us to combine then divide our assets. The clock said 4:35 a.m. The day before, Emily and I discussed the probability that one of us will be diagnosed schizophrenic. You're pretty much in the clear, I told her, because you're 25. And she said, no, I'm not. But she was 25. It's just that according to Google, she could still be schizophrenic without the symptoms and the signs yet. I was 22 and afraid of the Baker Act. So, when my gynecologist asked me why I was crying, I responded by asking if my vagina looks normal. I avoided the answers I left on the intake form and waited anxiously for our 35 minutes to be up and over. My clothes were draped over a plastic chair against one wall, and she sat on a stool in front of my legs. I prepared myself for our appointment by listing the ways in which sterility of an exam room keeps patients safe. I'm not a whore, I told her, and she believed me with swabs in her hands and a mask over her mouth. Then I looked up at the ceiling and thought about the third Gardasil shot and how I wished I'd gotten it earlier because now it was too late. She told me I probably didn't have HPV or anything else, and I didn't. Thank you.
And now to continue our reading, we'll have Colleen Mayo come up to introduce Zach.
Zach kind of sauntered into the first room I ever saw him in 3 years ago. He hasn't changed much since then, so you can all imagine it. That cool guy swagger, that skater boy from Cincinnati with a quick grin and not too many words about him. He sat in the back of our 6-week boot camp class, and most of the time, when I dared sneak a peek his way, he had this look like he'd rather be writing or smoking a cigarette or talking about Dennis Johnson or basically doing some combo of classic writer man stuff that made me feel like I both had to be his friend and also that he was probably an asshole. And I don't know when we became friends. I was terribly intimidated by every person around me, sinking with the fear that I wasn't shit, not smart or disciplined or talented or even fucking lucky enough to be here. And maybe at the end of the day, it was this fear that brought us together. Because Zach, it turned out, had also arrived with a few of his own demons yet to square away. Maybe our friendship developed over the course of braving a few wild workshops together, during which both of our noob green asses gave it everything we had and still got chewed out for our half-formed plots or our half-developed characters or, dare I say, our half-steps towards yearning, during which I feel like we both looked at one another from across the workshop table at some point and said, hey, I really like your writing, and I want to talk to you about it. And then eventually we made plans to go smoke cigarettes and talk about Dennis Johnson. 3 years. I'm sentimental tonight because we've both come to the end of our time here at the program, and now Zach's leaving, so, you know, I've started to take a new reflective look at our friendship, and what stands out is, wow, my friend is a great writer. There ain't no half anything about him, and between me and this room, I don't think there ever was. When you read Zach's work, you're in it. Much of his writing is a fraught love letter to Cincinnati, a city I never once thought that much about, but that now pops into my mind at random times, usually in the form of prose. This, Zach writes in a short story about his town, is the city's breath in April of 2001. Hard, mean, unsteady, An invisible pressure continues to build as though the skyscrapers and the bodegas and the churches and the projects are all beginning to sink, driven underground by some nameless force. The April temperatures rise, fall, then rise again. Children filter in and out of the schools, buses depart, return, depart again. The phantoms of office workers clock in, clock out. Small groups of protesters chant high and low as the sun climbs up and up and up before its descent home. Much of Zach's writing includes skating, a culture I've never been a part of, and yet again, I now find myself considering all the time. And a lot of Zach's writing focuses on loneliness, addiction, race, big, very present realities that are on or should be on all of our minds, and that we need to think about more, that we need to reckon with. And that's the thing about good writing, isn't it? Not only will the prose unfold something new and give you a piece of what you didn't even know you were craving, but it will also throw you exactly what you needed, what you feared, throw it straight in your face, make you consider. Zach is currently, but almost no longer, an MFA candidate in creative writing at Florida State University. His short stories and essays have appeared or are forthcoming in River Teeth, New South, Waterstone Review, among other journals. Please join me in welcoming him to the BARC stage.
Thanks, Colleen. You're the best. All right. Tonight I'm going to read a condensed version of my essay. It's called Put Your Ear to the Streets. It doesn't take learn to learn the synchronization of the stoplights on Liberty. At first glance, they may seem uneven, a rhythmic like an old drunk's heartbeat, but there's a pattern to it all, a pulse. And if you pay attention, you might be able to get to where you're going just a few minutes quicker. For instance, you hit that first green at John and you'll be able to coast by Central Ave without catching a red. But only if you let your foot fall heavy on the gas, and only if you don't get stuck behind another vehicle, one that's not in the kind of rush you're in. But if you do get caught at Central Ave, then you're going to get caught at Central Parkway too. And that's the worst one, a 45-second red light. If you want, though, you can look around while you wait. There's the abandoned Warner Brothers studio to your left, the Cincinnati Ballet to your right, or maybe something else catches your eye. Maybe a person crosses the street that looks like your brother, your sister, an old friend. Or maybe there's a homeless man with a cardboard sign begging for your attention, for a dollar, a quarter, a nickel. But if you're anything like I was, you don't see any of this. Because deep down in the pocket of your jeans is a quarter gram of heroin, and it's damn near impossible to notice anything when you've got a sack of dope whispering your name. I didn't grow up in Cincinnati. I didn't grow up in any of the nearby neighborhoods either. I grew up 20 miles north in the suburbs where I was raised in a two-story New England salt box constructed on a half acre of green fescue grass that my father taught me how to mow when I was 10 years old. I grew up next to neighbors who lived in homes similar to mine, who had families similar to mine, who raised children with the same hobbies as me, the same toys as me, the same color skin as me. Most of my early memories of the city, of downtown, revolve around going to Reds games with my family as a boy. But I don't remember the ball games themselves. What I remember is the walk to the stadium, the damp aroma of wet concrete and brick, cigarette smoke hovering over our heads like a morning fog, stepping on the rusted grates that line the sidewalks and wondering if they're going to break on me, if I'm going to fall through and somehow get trapped underneath the city streets forever. But what I remember most is giving pocket change to the street musicians, most of them black, pounding on plastic tubs and breathing life into beat-up saxophones with the passion of resuscitating a loved one. My father would hand me a few quarters, maybe, and I'd walk up and let the change fall into their collection bucket. Then I'd stare at them, wait for them to look back, to give me a thankful nod. A decade later, I was back, a crumpled 20 in my pocket, a hunger in my veins. After graduating high school, I split from the suburbs and moved into a three-story house with my older brother and six of his friends. We lived on Eden Ave in the neighborhood of Quarryville, a mile or so from downtown Cincinnati. Half of our neighbors were locals, the other half college students like us. Despite taking just two classes a semester, I soon found myself on academic probation and regularly visiting the university's rec center to steal money from the lockers to support my drug habit. A normal day for me looked like skipping class and driving to Over the Rhine to pick up my dealer, Wally. Wally didn't have a vehicle, so I'd run him around on errands in exchange for dope. He was black, lived in the projects on Lynn, and although it was tough to tell his age since he had a strange, youthful vibe to him, I'm guessing he was in his late 20s at the time. He had a close-shaved head and boyish features, yet his voice, his laugh, was deep. He'd usually be wearing a black tee and baggy jean shorts, occasionally a pistol tucked into his waistline. He steps into my memory, into my car, without making eye contact. "What's good?" he asks. I tell him nothing, and mean it. We're on John Street. It's 7 in the morning and my withdrawals are about to kick in. I feel them knocking against my chest, my skull, trying to break out. The sweats are next, but at least I know I'll be getting what I need. "Where are we going?" I ask. "Take me to Elm." I nod, drive off. It's quiet, static in the streets. The city's still waking. We pass by 100-year-old brick buildings of Queen Anne architecture with elaborate ornamentation and rounded cornices and shattered windows, homeless men on the stoops, empty 40s brown bagged between their feet. Wally starts messing with the radio. He changes his station a few times but ends up turning it off. He reclines his seat and shuts his eyes. The sun is red. The morning is cool. I can tell it's going to be a long day. That's how it went back then. Sometimes it'd only be a 30-minute drive. Pick Wally up on Lynn, drop him off at one of his buddies, and he'd throw me a cap on his way out. Other times we were together all afternoon. Every day was a little different. We'd go spot to spot as he made his deals. Maybe we'd pick up his girlfriend from work, drop her off at home. One time I drove a packed car of his family members to his little cousin's high school graduation. A 20-mile drive. During the trip, I listened to them joke and tell stories. I got to see Wally let his front down a little, too. When we pulled up to the convention center's parking lot, he handed me a $10 bill and a plastic-wrapped tenth of smack. "Good looking," he said. After running our errands, I'd drive back to the house on Eden and rush into my bedroom. I'd lock the door, take out my kit, spoon, spike, cotton, water, and do what people do with heroin, shoot it, put it in my body, and wait for that warmth to bury me, for that nod, for that feeling of unfeeling. Whether I was dope sick or high, at some point in the day I'd end up hanging out with Bernard. Bernard lived in the basement of our house on Eden. He was black, a Vietnam veteran, and a committed alcoholic. He was also one of my best friends at the time. I'd head down to his apartment in the afternoons and find him standing outside his back door, chain-smoking Winstons, his oxygen tank set up next to him like some dog on a leash. If he weren't wearing one of his dashikis, he'd be in his stained navy blue robe, his globe of a gut poking out from it. His skin was worn from being on Earth so long, but his head, bald and smooth, would catch the sun and throw a glare back toward the sky. Bernard was one of the few people who knew just how bad off I was, and he always did his best to help me out in his own unique way. Now, 7 years later, when I'm out on my porch smoking a cigarette or drinking my morning coffee, I sometimes picture those days. I can see it all so clearly, me walking around to the back of the house with a six-pack of Colt cans in my grip, Bernard already outside, already drinking, a cigarette stuck in his lips as though it were just some other part of his body. "Hey," he says, either to me or the booze. I'm not sure which. I hand him the beer and he reaches in his pocket to give me some pain pills, wrapped up in one-ply toilet paper as though he's bestowing some beautiful gift to me. "Here, boy," he says. "Now get off that dog food, you hear?" "Yeah, man," I tell him. "I'm serious. That shit will kill you." We sit down, I light a cigarette, and Bernard starts talking about everything and nothing at the same time. And before I realize it, the day is fading by. He tells stories of the war, of living in the South, of pain and women and the city. His voice is coarse, yet it's got a rich, soulful quality to it, the baritone of a heartbreaker. Even though he's weak, even though he's dying, he's still got so much damn life left in him. Shit, he mutters, and I nod. During all the time I spent with Bernard, I knew he just wanted to see me do well, to not make the same mistakes he had made throughout his life. And he had made a few. His record told the story. Multiple possession charges, DUIs, probation violations. He had also seemed to have burnt most of his familial bridges. His only consistent visitor was a sister that stopped by every few weeks to drop off food. At least he had the nurses from the VA to talk to. But for the most part, he was a lonely man. We both were. As the months wasted away, I evolved as an addict. Outside of giving rides to Wally, I discovered other methods of getting my drugs. I might take a handful of my roommate's quarters from his change cup and replace them with nickels. Another day, I might crawl around my bedroom for hours with a butter knife, digging into the carpet looking for lost morsels of dope and crushed pills. Or maybe I'd steal a few of my brother's DVDs and sell them to the CD Gam Exchange on Short Vine, where I worked for a couple of months before becoming one of their most regular pawners. During those years, I also had a credit card my parents paid for, but my mom would keep track of every transaction and I was only allowed to use it for gas and groceries. But I learned I could buy Wally phone cards at the Shell station and exchange them for dope, dollar for dollar. Or that I could take him to the Kroger's on Vine Street or in St. Bernard and buy him groceries, me pushing the shopping cart as Wally threw in whatever he needed to feed his family. I even took him shopping at the mall once. It was winter, a few days before Christmas, and he still needed to buy a couple presents for his family. I remember him lifting up a little boy's t-shirt, some kind of baseball stitched onto the chest, and holding it out in front of him. "What do you think?" he asks. "Is this dope?" At the time, I didn't realize I was witnessing the cycle of poverty and crime through Wally's struggles to support his family. And I didn't realize that this credit card I had, which to me meant an easy way to get drugs, meant for him a way to clothe his son, to buy food for the table, to survive. There were a lot of things I didn't notice back then. I guess I didn't notice them because I had the choice not to. The further down the spiral of addiction I went, the more Bernard and I fought. We were both hard-headed, and the booze and drugs would lead to petty arguments. He had a temper on him, there's no doubt about it. He was constantly bringing up how I didn't respect him enough, and looking back, he was probably right. Maybe I'd be playing my music too loud upstairs, or rolling around on my skateboard inside the house, or maybe some empty beer can fell from the back deck onto his grounds level. "Look at you," he'd shout, treating me like dirt. He'd get so worked up, sometimes his voice would break and I'd have to calm him down, tell him to smoke a cigarette or to go get his oxygen. Sometimes he'd even try to get physical with me. Other times, our arguments would end with the two of us in tears. But it wasn't always like that. There was peace, too. The kind of silence only two people who are close can share. Some days we'd go inside his apartment to hang out. There were just two windows on his entire level, and both of them were covered up, one by a portrait of his deceased mother, the other by a painting of an African lion. He had two lazy boys that sat next to each other with a side table in between. There was an ashtray packed to the rim with Winstons, a cluster of empty beer cans, incense burning a fragrant ghost into the stale air. And we'd sit there, both silent, watching Judge Joe Brown. Two bodies next to each other, one black, one white, one old, one young, both poisoned. It's 2010 now, summer, or maybe fall. It doesn't really matter. I'm in my Nissan mainlining I-75 South after leaving my parents' home. I'm going to meet up with Wally. It's 2 a.m. and I'm filled with an overwhelming sense of self-loathing for breaking my daily promise of getting clean, the promise I break every day. But I don't stop. I don't turn around. I hit the Hopple exit and follow Wally's directions. Pull up to some cheap $20 a day motel out on Central Ave. I shut off the engine, sit there in the dark, wait. Despite it being the middle of the night, doors open and close like blinking eyes, and every face I see is Wally's. Eventually, he comes out from one of the rooms with two girls shadowing close behind him. He walks up to my window as the girls get in the back seat. Drop them off, he says. They'll tell you where to go. He hands me a sack. I feel its weight in my palm and tell myself I'll be okay. You're not coming? I ask. Nah. He walks back to his room without saying another word. I throw a glance at the girls through the rear view. They're young, black. One of them has white beads attached to her hair, but I'm not able to get a good look in the dark. I ask them where we're going. Get us on McMicken, then we'll show you. I nod. I drive off. During the ride, I don't listen to what the girls talk about, but I do listen to their laughs, how innocent they sound, the high-pitched snickering of schoolgirls. That's when I notice the stench of recently smoked weed filling the car. I roll down the windows. How old are you guys? I ask. I'm 19, the one with the bead says. She's 18. We drive on, cutting through the heart of Over the Rhine. There's a sense of unease, some kind of unraveling going on inside my chest. Maybe it's because Wally isn't with us, or maybe it's some sort of intuition, a junky instinct telling me things aren't going to end well tonight. I'm not quite sure. There's a tow truck in front of us. They're driving too slow, even though they're traveling the speed limit. But I need to get back home. I need to get away from this city, away from the dark. I tailgate the truck until the last of my patience dies off, and I pull over to the right lane, a parking lane, and pass them. But when I do, I also pass the police cruiser that's driving directly in front of them, the cruiser I hadn't seen. Time stops for a moment, like when a ball is thrown straight into the sky and pauses at zero velocity before its descent back down to the earth. Then sirens, then blue and red lights pulsing the night air, shaking it. Fuck. I take my dope, shove it into my boxer briefs, and pull over all in one smooth motion. I ask the girls what their names are, and they give them to me. Okay, I say. I'm just driving you home for a friend, right? Right? I grab the steering wheel with both hands like it's the edge of some cliff. I look into the side view. The officer is approaching now, flashlight on, burning a line of light into the back of our heads. Questions are asked, then answered, and before I know it, backup is called. I find out the two girls are not 18 and 19, but 14 and 15. Please step out of the car, sir. Two more cruisers arrive and the cops split us up. The girls on one side of the street, me on the other. I keep telling one of the officers I'm doing a favor for my friend, Keith. Keith is Wally's real name, which I'm not supposed to know, but do. I figure that's what the two girls will be calling him. Keith said he needed a favor, I say. I'm just helping him out, that's all. I get patted down, nearly every inch of my body searched, but they don't find my dope. One of the cops gets on their walkie-talkie and calls in the dogs, but both sets are being used elsewhere, so they have to search my car manually. I stand there on the sidewalk, a streetlight above spilling a pale yellow onto the scene, and watch as they tear my Nissan up. Passersby slow down to look. A few neighbors come out of their apartments and watch. It feels like a play, the final act of some tragedy. Three cruisers with lights throbbing, two underage girls stoned on pot, and me, a 20-year-old kid with a bad habit. I tell the cop I'm a student at the university. I keep saying it over and over again like it's some key to get out of the situation unscathed, like it's a secret password. I haven't showed them my ID. I realize I'm pretending to be more scared than I actually am, pretending like the circumstances are against me. I shift the blame, manipulate the story, the situation. If I could fake cry, I would. To an extent, it is a play, and I'm performing in it, acting out the role of the scared white boy who somehow got trapped into a shitty situation. I was just trying to help out, I tell them. I was just doing a favor. In the end, The two girls get taken to lockup so their parents can pick them up, and I get off with a traffic ticket. I go home. I get high. I'm fast-forwarding a little bit. There were several vain attempts at sobriety throughout the next few months. I'd buy Suboxone off the street or bum tramadols from Bernard to help me wean off, or my mother would take me to the ER to get admitted for opiate withdrawals, where they prescribed me Valium, Clonidine, Trazodone, and some Imodium. I was fortunate my family had the money, the insurance, to get me real help. But in the end, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready until I was. For me, it was as simple as that. There was no burning bush, no moment of realization, no overdose-induced epiphany. I was just beat the fuck down. I got clean in 2011 and moved out of Eden into a one-bedroom apartment on the south side of campus. I enrolled in intensive outpatient rehab where I'd go a few times a week for classes and drug screenings. Since my roommates and I had all moved out of the house, I didn't see Bernard as much, but I'd still visit him from time to time. My memories from those years aren't the best, and I often get upset when I think about how little I remember the conversations we shared. But I do recall the last time I visited him. Since I was sober, it's my clearest memory of the two of us together. It's summertime, July maybe, and hot. I'm heading back to my new apartment when I make the impromptu decision to drive up Eden, check out the old house, see if maybe Bernard's out front on the porch. And of course he is. I park my Nissan on the street, walk up to him, and the first thing I notice is that shit-eating grin of his. I sit down, light up a cigarette, and we talk just like the old days. The new guy's living here, he says, looking ahead. Fuck 'em. Frat boys. They don't ever come visit me or nothing. They're not like your old crew. I watch him hit his Winston, his hands shaking. I want to grab hold of them, squeeze them until they find peace. He's glad I'm clean, of course, but I can also sense a sadness within him, as though he's upset I'm moving on without him. Upset that the one thing which first brought us together, our mutual attraction to self-destruction, will no longer bond us. I can tell he's afraid, too. Afraid we'll no longer spend time together. Afraid I'll no longer walk around back with a few tall boys and a fresh pack of smokes. Afraid I'll no longer sit in his lazy boy and watch television with him as the day burns away outside. And the worst part is he's right. And perhaps he's angry too, not specifically at me, but at the world for allowing people like me to get help so easily, while people like him so often get left behind. But whatever it is that's on his mind, he doesn't tell it to me. As the two of us go on talking, a young woman walks past us on the street. Bernard, being Bernard, yells out to her. There's no way around it. He's a catcaller. "Hey, mama," he shouts. The woman looks over, annoyed, of course, but her face softens when she sees Bernard's grin. She can't hold back her smile. Bernard points at me. "You see this boy right here?" he asks. "I see him," the woman says. "You might not be able to tell, but that's my son." An entire year passed before I went back to visit Bernard again. No one was home. And when I was returning to my car, I ran into one of the new residents, one of the frat boys. I asked him if Bernard was still living in the basement. "Black dude?" he asked. "We just moved in, but the people living here before said they found him dead a while back." I nodded, thanked the guy, and walked away. Just a black dude, I thought. He was more than that, of course. To me, he was a father, a brother, a friend. I loved him dearly. I never saw Wally after I got sober, and you don't have to tell me he was never my friend the way Bernard was. I know he was using me for rides, making money off me as I slowly killed myself, but I do believe there is at least some level of human connection between the two of us. I think back to when we'd be parked in my Nissan after dusk, Clay Street maybe, trapped between brick walls with the sun hidden, the sky red. The radio would be turned off because Wally was counting his money, the windows down and a damp April breeze falling through us. Maybe Wally had a good day that day. Maybe he knew he could afford his son that new pair of shoes, or that he could pay his rent on time. Maybe we talked about music for a while, or about the Bengals, or the city. Or maybe we wouldn't talk at all. Maybe we'd just sit there listening to the traffic crawl by, the both of us waiting for the next move. Not as friends and not as strangers, but as two guys from two different places, just trying to stay up. Whenever I'm in over the Rhine today, I sometimes catch myself looking for him, for Wally. I look for him because I have this feeling that if we were to meet again, that if he were to see me now, not quite as skinny, not quite as gaunt, as pale, and he'd ask me how I was doing, and I'd tell him I've been clean, that I graduated from college, that I moved all the way to Florida to become a writer, that I have friends and family that love me, that trust me, he'd be happy for me. Sure, maybe he'd ask if I was looking to cop, and maybe it'd be a joke, and maybe it wouldn't be. But either way, deep down, I think he'd be glad to see me still alive, still breathing. When I think back on those years, I don't see specific moments, but a compilation of them, all thrown together in some bent-up spoon with a flame underneath, and the moments, the memories, boiling together into something unclear, something meaningful, something real. But I do remember a few things. I remember the city. I remember heat and cold, steel and rust. I remember the way the streetlights pulsed green and red and how the homeless lay peacefully atop the stairs of the old church on Vine, their skin weather-beaten, their eyes worn. I remember beauty and pain and children skipping down the sidewalks, smiles on their faces masking an understanding of what this world actually is. I remember the way the smoke crawled from the vents, rising into the air like the cough of a dying man on a cool November day. Can a city be alive? Can it breathe like you and me? Can it give life? Can it kill? Don't ask me. Ask Wally. You might find him shooting dice on Ray Street or walking his son hand in hand to grab dinner at Richie's. Step up and see what he has to say about this city. I'm sure he's got a few stories to tell.